begun to work our way through the whole of the scriptures, doing a survey of the Bible. And we've begun by looking generally at the Bible as a whole to get an overview. And then last time, which was two Sundays ago, we looked at the first book of Moses, the first book of the Bible, Genesis. And so now, logically enough, we're coming on to look at the second. That is the book of Exodus. Exodus gets its title from the Greek word for departure or for exit, and it's an appropriate title because it refers to the departure or the exit of the people of Israel from the land of Egypt. Before we come to look at the content, just a little bit about the dating of the book and the events in the book. Moses would have written this probably round about the time or shortly after what is described in this book, because towards the end we have the instructions from God about the building of the tabernacle, and then the tabernacle is in fact built. And so it would be some time after the construction of the tabernacle that this was given to Moses. As to the precise date when that happened, well, that is the subject of historical controversy. You might remember that we worked out that Jacob would have arrived in Egypt round about the year, and these are obviously approximate, 1875 BC. And we are told that Israel was in Egypt for a period of 430 years. Adding these numbers together, or rather taking one away from the other, because of course numbers BC go backwards, we arrive at a date of approximately 1445 BC. Now you can work the other way. You can work, for example, from 1 Kings, chapter 6. This tells us, came to pass in the 480th year, after the children of Israel had come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, which is the second month, that he began to build the house of the Lord. Now, Solomon's temple was begun in the year 965, so then you add on 480 years, the period between the Exodus and the building of the temple, and you get 1445 BC. So from two different points of view, you come up with exactly the same date. However, there are some people, if you read some commentaries and some books that deal with the subject, they argue that it couldn't have been 1445 BC because Egypt was in a very powerful position at that time, and there is no way in which the events described in Exodus fit in. So what they do is to say, let's find a hole in Egyptian history where we can fit in the period of the Exodus. And they find one, or they think they find one, round about the year 1290. Now that, of course, screws up 1 Kings 6:1, because that's brought it back 100 and something years. So that means then you've not got 480 years. So what they argue is that here you have 1240s. And so what is being said is not it was exactly 480 years, but it was 1240s. 40 is a generation, so it's an approximate number, and so therefore you wouldn't expect it to be exactly 480 years. So in fact, it's only 300 and something or other. So it is argued. And this is argued by scholars. Now, the reason why they feel they must do this is because finding this slot in Egyptian history, there doesn't seem to be a suitable one. Well, I think their approach to the subject is not a biblical one. The Bible is the word of God. The Bible is true. If the Bible doesn't agree with Egyptian history, so much the worse for Egyptian history. The Egyptians got it wrong, or we have misunderstood Egyptian history. Now, they try and tie it in some way or other with the arrival of a group of people called the Hyksos. The Hyksos were a group of Asiatics who came and took over Egypt. And what we find mentioned in Exodus is that a pharaoh arose over the land of Egypt who did not know Moses. Who did not know Joseph. And it is suggested that the reason he didn't know Joseph was because he was one of these new race of people, the Hyksos, who came and took over Egypt. Well, it's a possibility. Others suggest various other views. I will, for what it's worth, tell you what I happen to think, and you can find this in a book called The Exodus Problem and Its Ramifications, which goes into great detail of Egyptian history and also looks at radiocarbon dating. You'll also find a view that is not totally dissimilar to this, put forward by a non-Christian by the name of Velikovsky, who has some rather unorthodox views from the point of view of Egyptology. He basically takes the same line that Egyptian history has been completely cocked up and people get it completely wrong in their understanding of it. And he pushes all of Egyptian history, or he rather compresses it. And that is essentially, I think, what is the case. And I think what you find is this, that a new pharaoh arose who did not know Joseph. That is, he wasn't around, he wasn't born at the time of Joseph, and so therefore he completely forgot him. He didn't know Joseph at all. Who is this guy? Well, we read about him in history books, but that's all. Then we have the events of the early part of Exodus. There are plagues. The crops are destroyed. The morale of the country is destroyed. The whole economy, because of the plagues, is completely smashed to pieces. And then after the plagues, the firstborn of Egypt die. Following that, the Israelites are allowed to leave, and then the Pharaoh changes his mind, he sends his army out to get them and bring them back. But then the army is destroyed in the Red Sea. Well, if your economy is destroyed, your morale is destroyed, a large proportion of your young people have been destroyed, and your army is destroyed, it's not going to be that difficult for someone to just walk in and take over the country. And from what I've seen, and obviously I'm not the world-leading expert on this, but from what I've seen, it is a much better explanation to say that in the light of that, the Hyksos just came in and took over. Now that would mean dating the Hyksos period later than is currently done in Egyptology. And it does depend on a number of things. Egyptologists feel somewhat confident of their dates in Egyptian history. They have taken artifacts of known date and they've dated them using radiocarbon dating, and they're fairly confident. The problem is, from my point of view, is that the assumptions behind radiocarbon dating are false, and they don't take those false assumptions into account when they do their dating. If they took the correct assumptions into account, I won't go into the details as to what those assumptions are, but if they made the right assumptions, which can be proved and demonstrated, then they would come up with different dates and it would shift everything forward in time. And so therefore that would fit in with what I'm suggesting about this. So let's now look in a little more detail at what we find in this book. I'm splitting it up into a number of sections just for convenience. First of all, we get the general introduction, telling us about the tribes and the fact that the people of Israel multiplied, but in multiplying they were then placed into bondage, and taskmasters were put over them, they became slaves, and they were forced to build things. So for example, verse 11 of chapter 1, therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramesses. But the more they affected them, the more they multiplied and grew. And here you can say this is part of the fulfillment of the promises made to Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, that they would be the ancestors of a great nation. This is God fulfilling his promises. But starting from coming down into Egypt, then we get this situation because of this king, verse 8, who did not know Joseph. They are put into bondage, but they continue to grow. And so then what the Pharaoh says is, okay, we can't have this. If they continue growing like this, they'll take over the country. So therefore, all male children will be put to death. Verse 16, when you do the duties of a midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stools, if it is a son, then you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the male children alive. And so the king tells them off and says, why have you done this? And the midwives say, well, it's because the Hebrew women aren't like the Egyptian women. When they give birth, it's a question of, and as it flops, before we even get there. So we can't carry out your instructions. So Pharaoh commanded all his people, verse 22, saying, every son that is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive. So this was a very crude means of birth control upon the Israelites to keep the numbers down, in order that the Egyptians would not be swamped by Israelites. So that's a bit of the background to the rest of the book. Israel is in bondage, they're being severely oppressed, very unpleasant situation, and into this situation Moses is born. And so we have from chapter 2 through to the end of chapter 7, we have the birth, growth and call of Moses. Moses is one of the most significant people in the whole of the Old Testament. Moses, born, his mother didn't want him to die, and so she cooked up this scheme to put him in this small ark of bulrushes and floated off to Pharaoh's daughter. So that Pharaoh's daughter, it was hoped, would take pity on him and adopt him. And of course, that is exactly what happened. And Moses was taken into the royal household and brought up as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. And the wonderful thing about it in God's providence is that Pharaoh's sister was there and said to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I find a nursemaid for you? Oh, yes, please do. So off she goes and gets her mother. So Moses' own mother was used by Pharaoh's daughter as a nursemaid. We then have the account of Moses when he had grown, being fully educated in the ways of Egypt, how he tried to sort out a fight. Came to pass in those days, verse 11 of chapter 2, when Moses was grown, he went out to his brethren and looked at their burdens. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that, and when he saw no one, he killed the Egyptian and hit him in the sand, thinking he got away with it. And when he went out the second day, behold, two Hebrew men were fighting, and he said to one who did the wrong, why are you striking your companion? Then he said, who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you intend to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? So then Moses realized it was known, and he fled away to the land of Midian, and there he married and became a shepherd and had children and was content looking after his flocks. Now it was after Moses had been there some considerable time, and looking at the data you can find that Moses was perhaps around about 40 when he fled to Midian, and he was there for about 40 years. Then you find that in chapter 3 Moses is caring for the flocks, and then something very unusual happens. He is at Mount Sinai, or as it's sometimes called, Mount Horeb, and he sees this bush burning. And in seeing the bush burning, he realizes that there are no ashes being formed, the bush is not being consumed. And so he comes close to the bush and then God speaks to him out of the bush, and God commissions Moses to become the deliverer of Israel. He says, right, you are going to go back to Egypt, you are going to stand before Pharaoh, and you are going to demand of Pharaoh that he lets the people of Israel go. And God tells Moses, but he won't let you go. So you're going to have to perform miracles and signs and wonders. And having performed these miracles, signs and wonders, still he won't let you go. So then plagues will come that I will send. And then after I've sent them, eventually you will be let go with all the people. And there is a promise given at the end of the chapter, verse 21 of chapter 3. I will give this people favour in the sight of the Egyptians, and it shall be, when you go, you shall not go empty-handed, but every woman shall ask of her neighbour, namely, and of her who dwells near her house, articles of silver, articles of gold, and clothing, and you shall put them on your sons and on your daughters, so you shall plunder Egypt. So another aspect of the economy of Egypt being ruined, they lost a great deal of their wealth and their possessions as well. Moses tries to get out of this and say, me? But I've got a speech impediment, or whatever his impediment was. I can't speak clearly. And don't send me, send someone else. Moses tries every way to get out of it, and God says, no, you're the man, you're going. But because you say that you can't speak properly, Aaron will be your prophet. And so Aaron is assigned to be Moses' prophet. And so off he goes back to Egypt, having been commissioned by God to do this, and presents himself first of all to the people of Israel, and then presents himself before Moses. And then presents himself before Pharaoh. But in presenting himself before Pharaoh, Pharaoh gets annoyed and says, right, well, if your people have always been a lazy lot, so in that case, you can go off and you can make all the bricks that you had to make in the past, but this time you'll make them without straw. Straw is a necessity in the making of bricks. So we have in verse 13, the taskmasters forced them to hurry, saying, fulfill your work, your daily quota, as when there was straw. And he says, how do you expect us to do this? The response is, you're idle, verse 17. You are idle, therefore you say, let us go and sacrifice to the Lord. And so the Egyptians make it even harder and are harsher towards them. And so Moses then comes under the condemnation of the Israelites, saying, you started all this. We didn't want this. We were okay as we were before, just being beaten and whipped and lashed, and were able to get away with doing these things, making these bricks, and now we've got to do the same without the straw, just as many. This is impossible. And they decided to take it out on Moses. But then God deals with Moses, speaks to him again, and says, don't worry, now Pharaoh will start to see the power of God at work. And so we have this introduction to Moses and to the conflict between God and Pharaoh, setting the scene. Pharaoh is implacably imposed to obeying the commands of God, and so God says, right, now I will get glory over Pharaoh. And we find this refrain begins to appear in chapter 7 and verse 13. And Pharaoh's heart grew hard, and he did not heed them, as the Lord had said. And you'll notice this is a refrain that continues right the way through after virtually every plague. And so then, chapter 7, verse 14, through to the end of chapter 11, we have the plagues of Egypt. First of all, 7:14 to the end of the chapter, the waters in Egypt are turned to blood. Now, if you watch The Ten Commandments, the film by Cecil B. DeMille, you would get the impression that all that caused this was something further upstream up the Nile that was just disgorging this red stuff into the river, and that's what the cause of it was. But what you find is, verse 19 of chapter 7, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, say to Aaron, take your rod and stretch out your hand over the waters of Egypt, over their streams, over their rivers, over their ponds, and over all their pools of water, that they may become blood. And there shall be blood throughout all the land of Egypt, both in vessels of wood and in vessels of stone." So even though you had a jug of water in the house that you got from the Nile yesterday, when Moses stretched out his hand, it wasn't just what you collected today from the Nile. What was yesterday's water would also have been turned into blood. Now, I've mentioned Velikovsky already. Velikovsky suggests that there was some volcanic eruption at a distance, and that as a result of this eruption, all this dust and ash was brought over the land of Egypt, and the dust and ash was composed of iron oxide, and iron oxide is red, and so this is what turned everything red. It's a suggestion that's made. I think that in this case it was clearly a miracle. Doesn't mean that God doesn't sometimes use means in his providence to do such things, but it says blood, and I think it's not saying it will be blood coloured, it will be blood. And it happened. And for 7 days they had no water to drink. They couldn't drink the water from the river. For 7 days the Lord struck the river. And Pharaoh, verse 22, the magicians of Egypt did so. They repeated this with their own enchantments by their black magic. And Pharaoh's heart grew hard, and he did not heed them, as the Lord had said. So then, another plague. Moses goes to Pharaoh and says, let my people go that I may serve them. If you refuse, there'll be another plague. All your territory will be smitten with frogs. So then, everywhere, frogs came out of the river, and so you'd have frogs jumping up around you, jumping over your bed, under your bed, across your table. When you were sitting on the loo, there'd be frogs jumping over you. There'd be frogs jumping up from in the loo. They would be everywhere. And this was driving people bananas. But what we find is that Pharaoh says, okay, sort this out, says to Moses. Moses says, okay, we'll get rid of them. So the frogs died, and they swept them up, and they gathered them in heaps, which stank. Verse 15, but when Pharaoh saw that there was relief, he hardened his heart and did not heed them as the Lord had said. So then, another plague, a plague of lice. And so there's lice throughout the land. Not very nice. Verse 18 of chapter 8. The magicians so worked their enchantments to bring forth lice, but they couldn't. Then the magicians said to Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. Suddenly the magicians are beginning to learn. But Pharaoh didn't. Pharaoh's heart grew hard, and he did not heed them, just as the Lord had said. But then there was another plague, the plague of flies throughout the land, flies swarming everywhere. Now, you go walking around the fields in midsummer, and you see the cows flicking their tails and swishing their heads, trying to get rid of the flies that are all over them. But this was far worse. Flies were everywhere. And Pharaoh tries to get rid of this. Pharaoh called Moses in, verse 25, go and sacrifice to your God in the land. And Moses says, no, we've got to go out of the land in order to do this. So Pharaoh says, I will let you go. Verse 28. So the plague comes to an end. The Lord did according to the word of Moses. The flies went. Not one remained. But Pharaoh hardened his heart at this time also. Neither would he let the people go. So then there was a fifth plague. A disease upon the livestock. So all the animals of Egypt were struck down with pestilence, with severe illnesses. And again, when the plague passed. That is when all the livestock died. Verse 6, the Lord did this thing on the next day, and all the livestock of Egypt died. But the livestock of the children of Israel, not one died. When the plague was over, Pharaoh sent, and indeed not even one of the livestock of the Israelites was dead, but the heart of Pharaoh became hard, and he did not let the people go. And you begin to think, this guy is crazy. His country is being destroyed. It's being smashed to pieces. It's being brought to its knees. And he's still being stubborn and refusing to listen to God. Anybody with any sense, even John Major, depending on what view you have of John Major, of course, would see, this is not good for the country, we'll let them go. But then there's another plague, and this time it's a plague of boils upon the person. And all the Egyptians, not the people in the Israelites, but all the Egyptians were covered with boils. I don't know if you've ever had a boil, but they're not very nice. And these people were smothered in them. And the magicians couldn't stand before Moses because of the boils. For the boils were on the magicians, as well as on all the Egyptians. But then you notice there is a change. It doesn't say that Pharaoh hardened his heart as he had before. It says, but the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, and he did not heed them. Things are being taken out of Pharaoh's hands. Pharaoh has been given the chance and the opportunity. Now God's patience is almost completely run out, and his opportunity is gone. So then we have a seventh plague, hail upon the land. And hail comes down from the sky, and of course it is extremely destructive. Not the sort of hail that we would think of, but enormous hailstones falling down upon the land. So Moses stretches out his hand, down comes the hail. Verse 25, the Lord sent thunder and hail, fire darted to the ground, the Lord rained hail upon the land of Egypt. And there was hail and fire mingled with the hail, so very heavy that there was none like it in all the land of Egypt since it became a nation. And the hail struck throughout the whole land of Egypt, all that was in the field, both man and beast. And the hail struck every herb of the field and broke every tree of the land. So all the crops have been destroyed. There's no animals left. They've all been killed. Now all the crops have gone. What are these people going to feed on? And you've got this crazy man who's in control. So this time he sends for Moses and Aaron, and he says in verse 27, the Lord is righteous and my people and I are wicked. Oh, he's beginning to get some sense, you think. And so the plague comes to an end. Verse 24, but when Pharaoh saw that the rain and hail and the thunder had ceased, he sinned yet more. And he hardened his heart, he and his servants. For the heart of Pharaoh was hard. So he's been given another chance. He hardens his own heart. Then there's the eighth plague. Locust. There would have been some crops left. Smashed to the ground, yes. So you couldn't harvest them in a normal way. But you could have got the food off of the ground if they'd have got out there quickly enough. But then the eighth plague was a swarm of locusts. Like a big black cloud coming over the land. They came in upon the land, and it ate all the crops. Locusts are very, very efficient devourers of crops. They still have swarms of locusts in the world today, particularly in Africa. And they still are not able to control them properly. How much less can they control them in ancient Egypt? So as a result of this, there's nothing green left on the trees or on the plants of the field. Chapter 10, verse 15. The Pharaoh again says, I've sinned against the Lord. Now forgive me, that God may take away this death away from us. So Moses goes out, and the swarm is blown away into the Red Sea. But there weren't any locusts remaining. But then verse 20, the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart and did not let the children of Israel go. Then we have a ninth plague, darkness over the land. You couldn't see a thing. It wasn't just an eclipse of the sun, because eclipses only last a matter of hours. This lasted for days. In all the land of Egypt there was thick darkness for 3 days. And eventually Moses is called in by Pharaoh. Go serve the Lord, only let your flocks and your herds be kept back, let your little ones also go with you. Moses said, no, it's got to be all of us. And in verse 27, the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart and would not let them go. And then we come to chapter 11 and the announcement of the death of the firstborn. And God says to Moses, this is the last plague. After this plague you will be driven from the land by Pharaoh and all the Egyptians. So this is the moment, verse 2, go and speak to all the men and all the women to go and get all the goodies from all their neighbours. Verse 2, verse 3, the Lord gave the people favour in the sight of the Egyptians, and they would have been weighed down with great wealth and possessions. And then we come up to the final plague, which culminates in chapter 12, with the Passover. Now the Passover is very important because this is something that was instituted by God as an indication to them of what was to be done by Christ. The death of the firstborn, Jesus Christ, is the firstborn of the Father, the firstborn of all creation. Jesus Christ was sacrificed, his blood was shed for us, in the same way that the lamb was offered at the time of Passover. Its blood was shed, and its blood was taken and sprinkled upon the lintels and the doorpost, so that when the angel of death came, when the angel saw on the lintel and the doorpost the blood of the sacrifice, the angel of death would pass over. So that when the blood of Christ is applied to us, the judgment passes over us and does not affect us. And this is the great festival of Judaism from this time right the way down to the present day. The sad thing is that modern Jews don't understand its true significance because they reject Christ. And so then the Jews are told, right, you must be prepared, no leaven in your bread because you have not time to wait for the bread to rise, loins girded, that is, your clothes tucked up around your waist so that you can run. You will eat it standing, so you're immediately ready to go. Because when this plague comes, the Egyptians will want you out as soon as possible. And so then, that night, at midnight, the Lord struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the house of Pharaoh to the house of the captive who was in the dungeon. They all died. So there was a great outcry in Egypt, and so they were told, go, 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 and they were thrust out. And so the people of Israel at last were delivered and set free, and they left Egypt with great wealth, with all their livestock, with much food, which was not available to anybody else in Egypt because of the plagues that had fallen upon the rest of Egypt, and they headed off into the wilderness. We then have the journeying from Egypt to Mount Sinai, and we have several laws instituted in chapter 13, and then they arrive at the Red Sea, or the Sea of Reeds. People often refer to this as the Red Sea, but it's not in fact the Red Sea, it's the Sea of Reeds. It would have been somewhere round about where the Suez Canal is at the moment. Doesn't mean that it was just an area of muddy ground, as is suggested by some liberals, because then how could it be that, as we read further on, the Egyptians were drowned? You don't get drowned in mud. But they come up to this sea, this lake, whatever it actually was, and they were fenced in. Now, if it was merely mud, then they could have walked through it. But it was a barrier to them. But God held off the Egyptian army that had been sent to bring them back by Pharaoh. And God parted the water so that Israel could go through and be delivered. And then when Israel was through, the Egyptians tried to follow, and God brought the water back on top of them. And the Egyptian army was drowned. And this caused great rejoicing that God had delivered them. We have the song of Moses in the next chapter, and the song of Miriam. And God then, we read, provides for them in remarkable ways. We find bitter water being made sweet at the end of chapter 15. And then we find the provision of manna from heaven in chapter 16. The word manna means, what is it? Because when they saw the manna coming down and laying upon the ground, people of Israel said, "Ooh, what's that? What is it?" And so that's what it was called. It was called manna. And so when you see Christian bookshops that call themselves manna, then you can go in and say, "Well, that's an interesting name for a bookshop. What is it?" So the people of Israel come up to Mount Sinai, provided for by God. We read about water from rock. We read about the problems that Moses was having in governing the people. And Jethro, his father-in-law, gives him some instruction in what we might term modern management principles. How to deal with the people. You organise them in this way, you have a hierarchy, and all the difficult problems come to you, but all the simpler problems are dealt with further down the chain of command. That's what you find in chapter 18. In chapter 19, they arrive at Mount Sinai, the mountain of God. And then we have, at Mount Sinai, we have a covenant made by God with the people of Israel. And the covenant is given and stated in a very solemn fashion, as all such covenants were. You find that the covenant made here with Israel is not totally dissimilar to that made between a conquering king and his vassal in the country that he's taken over, a vassal being a puppet king. And there are obligations placed upon the vassal and the subjects of that land, and certain promises made. If you keep this law, then I will bless you in this way. If you keep this law, I'll protect you and preserve you. That sort of thing. And that's exactly what we find when God gives the law. But then we have the covenant itself, which is the Ten Commandments, and various laws associated with it. Now, a lot of people don't realize this. They think the covenant is everything that's given. But the Bible actually says, and you can find this in Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 13. Deuteronomy 4:13. So God declared to you his covenant, which he commanded you to perform. That is the Ten Commandments. And he wrote them on two tablets of stone. So the Ten Commandments here in Exodus 20 is the covenant that was given. And everything else are, if you like, the bylaws of the covenant. But they are not the covenant itself. But these are given in chapter 19 and following through to the end of chapter 24. So there's a number of things here about violence, control of animals, property, various moral and ceremonial principles, things about justice, more about the law of the Sabbath. And then in chapter 24, Israel confirms the covenant, and Israel is terrified when it hears the thunders coming down from the mountains, and they beg that they might not have to hear this and see this again. They live in fear and trembling and say to Moses, "No, you deal with God. We're too afraid." So then, chapter 25 through to chapter 31, we have the tabernacle being described, the plans given to Moses on the mountain. And Moses is told to make everything according to the pattern that is revealed to him on the mountain. The writer to the Hebrews picks up on this in his letter. and through to chapter 31, all the details of the tabernacle and the function and service of the tabernacle are given. All the things associated with it, including the priesthood and the anointing of Aaron and his sons. And then they begin to build the tabernacle. Leads up to the point at which Moses is given everything. He's had a full description of all the things that are going to go into the tabernacle, and he's even told in chapter 31 that God will give special gifts to certain people. 31:2. See, I have called by name Bezaleel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah, and I have filled him with the Spirit of God in wisdom, in understanding, in knowledge, and in all manner of workmanship, to design artistic works, to work in gold, in silver, in bronze, in cutting jewels for setting, in carving wood, and to work in all manner of workmanship. Indeed, I have appointed with him Aholiab, the son of Ahizamach, of the tribe of Dan, and I have put wisdom in the hearts of all who are gifted artisans, that they may make all that I have commanded you. So the workers were given the abilities as well that were necessary to do this. But all this, Moses is up on the mountain. Meanwhile, down in the camp, because Moses is up there a long time, they think, well, where's Moses got to? What are we going to do? And so the people fall into idolatry, and we have the appalling description of the golden calf, where they made this calf to be a god to go before them, and they fall down and they worship it. And when Moses comes down from the mountain, Moses is not surprisingly furious. Already they've broken the covenant, and the covenant was only formed a matter of weeks before this, and yet already they've broken the covenant. They've broken the first commandment: you shall have no other gods before me, you shall have no graven images. And this is what they've done. And we find that it is such an appalling thing that there is great condemnation comes upon them. And so the idolatry is dealt with. It's sorted out in chapters 32 and 33. In chapters, the remaining chapters, verse chapter 34, the covenant is renewed. Moses makes two new tables of commandments, two new tablets, because the first ones are smashed. He throws them down to the ground. And the covenant is renewed. We'll come back to chapter 34 later. And then chapter 35 to the end, we have the beginning of the construction of the tabernacle. And right at the end, the tabernacle having been constructed, then the cloud covered the tabernacle. This is chapter 40, verse 34. The cloud covered the tabernacle of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter the tabernacle of meeting, because the cloud rested above it. And the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And so here we have a glorious sight. The beginning of the nation of Israel was one of great glory, even though, right at the beginning, they were guilty of idolatry, in spite of all that God had done for them. Points to note in the whole of the book. First of all, chapter 16. People often, when they're talking about the Sabbath, they will go to Exodus 20 and to verse 4, and they'll say, verse 8, here we find, remember the Sabbath day. And they say, right, remember what? Are they to remember about it? Well, it's obviously remember back to Genesis chapter 2. But I don't believe it says that. I think it's saying remember back to Exodus chapter 16. Because the Sabbath was instituted not in Genesis 2, but in Exodus 16. Verse 4, and the Lord said to Moses, behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a certain quota every day, that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not. And it shall be on the sixth day that they shall prepare what they bring in, and it shall be twice as much as they gather daily, in order that on the seventh day, they don't need to collect any. And the miracle was that if you kept some overnight for the next day, it rotted, except what you collected on the sixth day. If you kept it overnight, it did not rot. And so here is God working miraculously with these people to teach them something. And in verse 22 to 30, and so it was on the sixth day that they gathered twice as much bread, two omers for each one, and all the rulers of the congregation came and told Moses. Then he said to them, "This is what the Lord has said. Tomorrow is a Sabbath, rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake today, and boil what you will boil, and lay out for yourselves all that remains, to be kept until morning." So they laid it up until morning, and Moses